All right, let's go around and say names. Domio.
Bob.
Bob.
Mewtwo.
Mewtwo.
Rick.
Bruce.
David.
Nikki.
Shibetsu.
Don.
Michelle.
Richard.
Mark.
Margie.
Russell.
Dave.
All right. Oops. Pulled out my microphone again. Let's see. We're in between Shuso's. So Shoketsu was Shuso, and she would make the announcements. Myoju is our next Shuso. She's not installed yet, so I'm kind of like, oh yeah. Let's see. We do have a one-day retreat coming up in April 20th. Now, originally, it was on the calendar for the 27th, but that has been changed, so please consider coming to that. Very, very sweet, very beneficial for your meditation practice and for building Sangha. So that's a 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. just silent meditation retreat here. Very simple. You can come for part of the day if you can't come for the whole thing. You could arrive for the, just come for the morning or just come for the afternoon. Let's see. So, and if you are going to be coming, it's helpful if you let me know, particularly if you're going to be here for the morning, because we do a silent work period, and we have to come up with, you know, how many people are going to be here and how many work assignments can we scrounge up. And then, actually the 28th, so the reason that we moved that one-day retreat is because now the Sunday, April 28th, is Dharma Cloud Lineage Day. I always feel like maybe we should be like dogs and just, ooh, whoever's in trouble. So we will have a regular program here on that day, but it'll probably be something of a skeleton crew because we're emphasizing people coming over to the east side to Dharma Rain Zen Center. And that day is going to be specifically kind of geared to those of us in the Dharma Cloud lineage, which means Kyogen Gyokugo Carlson and all of their students. So I'm one of their students, Shintai's one of their students. There's a lay teacher in Hood River who leads a group. There's Sato, who's down in Eugene, who has a group. There's a group in Sandy, Y East Zen Center. So there's this kind of, we're kind of a family. We're all in this Dharma family together. So all of those groups are sending representatives to Dharma Rain. There's going to be, their program starts at 8:30. So we will join together for Zazen and service. Then there's a little break, and the Dharma talk is going to be a panel talk and discussion with me and Kakumyo, who's the abbot at Dharma Rain, and Sato, who is the teacher down in Eugene, about lineage, about the significance of lineage and why this matters. So, and then there will be a community lunch that people are invited to, and an optional tour of their campus. And that part of the day is open to anybody who wants to attend. And then there's going to be an afternoon session where we're asking for, I think we already have like 6 people, but we can send as many as 10 delegates from Brightway. And the only reason we're limiting the number is just because we want kind of proportional representation from all the different groups. So we also told Dharma Rain they could only send 10 people. So it's not just like you know, a Dharmarine thing. It's each group will have, and then we can have an intimate enough session, kind of getting to know one another, discussing things that are of importance to various groups. And I think that's been one of the most enjoyable things in the past for me, when I get together with people who lead a similar, relatively small groups. That's what's, it's really fun. Like, oh, you do that? Really? You offer, oh, you started then. When you chant that, or you like, you know, you get these ideas from each other and you talk about similar challenges and things like that. So if you are particularly interested in attending that afternoon session, let me know. Otherwise, just there's been a link in the newsletter. There's a lovely event page on the website. Just look into that if you want to go over to Dharmarine that morning. There's going to be a bunch of us doing that, including me and Shintai. So consider going to check out the mothership on that Sunday.
Is there going to be Mondo on the day of the all-day retreat?
I don't think so, more people tend to come when we do Mondo. I don't know. Those of you who are considering the retreat at all, what do you think? Yes or no?
Yes.
Simple day of sitting, or kind of raising the ante, and then we study. If we do Mondo, that means we pick a text for the day, the talks, talk about that, if there's any talks, and then in the afternoon, then there's we have a formal question ceremony where people who attend can present a verse and take questions on it, kind of like we did with Shirketsu last weekend. Any thoughts, if you're thinking at all about the retreat? No Mondo?
Sitting.
So are you a no Mondo vote and a yes Mondo vote?
Mondo just replaces the stretching, right?
Yeah. It takes a little longer.
That's a stretch.
Yeah.
That's a stretch.
You go away.
I mean, that is one possibility, is that we could just, because we usually wrap up at 4:30. We could make it go to 5:30 and really just have a full day, you know, the full day of Zazen as we would, but then just tack on Mondo at the end for anybody who wants to stay for it. I'll talk to Shintai about it. What? Anything else, anybody? Oh, and then also just if you are interested in taking the precepts on May 19th, Sunday, May 19th, I'm formally becoming a Zen Buddhist. About it, let me know. There's information on the website about it. There's been links in our email about it. And if you want to get our email and you haven't been, it's usually just a weekly little newsletter thing, just make sure you sign our guest book. Or you can go on the website, actually, and directly sign up for it. Okay.
Has the newsletter been released this week?
Has what?
It went out. The newsletter went out this week.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I guess I can see it.
Yeah, it's generally, it's released on Friday morning. Our admin assistant, I guess, according to research, like, mornings are good time to release it. It's like Friday mornings. So we always have, it scheduled, so it'll just go bing out at 8 a.m. on Friday. All right.
So today, I'm giving a talk on the five hindrances. So I have just released two podcast episodes on this, and it's going to go into a third episode because it's a rich topic. So if you are at all, the talk I'm going to give today is pretty much an overview of all five hindrances and how to do, what they are and how to deal with them. And if you're at all interested in going any deeper into it, then check out the podcast episodes. And there's links to those in the weekly newsletter, but then you can also just go to the Zen Studies podcast website or subscribe. So The five hindrances. They're not actually something that I have, that have been a big part of my practice in the past. But one of the reasons I really love doing the podcast is because then what I'm doing is I'm working my way through what I call the Buddha's teachings. So the essential teachings of the Buddha. So I'm going Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Four Foundations of Mindfulness, da da da. So the idea is if you want like a basic Buddhist education, you could just, you know, work your way through these podcasts. So then I get to something like the five hindrances and I'm like, But then when I really delve into them, you know, I almost always find that they're really cool. So the idea is that in our practice or in our meditation, when we feel like we're facing an obstacle or we're stuck in some way, basically the Buddha said, what's happening is one or more of these five hindrances is present. So it's a pretty, like, if you're just, it's pretty infallible. If you sit there and you're meditating and you're just, I don't know, you know, it's just, yeah, we're not supposed to have a goal and we're not supposed to make anything happen, but sometimes it's just obvious. It's kind of like you're kind of wasting your time there. You know, what is it? If you examine it, it's probably one of these five hindrances that is arising. So the first is, and this is where it'd be nice to have a little handout perhaps with the five, but I didn't get around to it. It's often translated as sense desire, but it's, I think more it's worldly desire or worldly, actually kind of obsession, which I will get into more about that. Ill will. The third is sloth and torpor. So I'll explain, but it's hyphenated. It's actually a compound term. Sloth and torpor. Four is restlessness and worry. Another compound, restlessness and worry. Or uncertainty, which is like also can be called skeptical doubt. So this is from the Avarana Sutta. So the Blessed One, or the Buddha, said, these five are obstacles, hindrances that overwhelm awareness and weaken discernment. Which five? Sensual desire is an obstacle, a hindrance that overwhelms awareness and weakens discernment. Ill will, sloth and drowsiness, restlessness and anxiety. So slightly different translations. Uncertainty is an obstacle, a hindrance that overwhelms awareness and weakens discernment. When a monk has not abandoned these five obstacles, when he is without strength and weak in discernment, it is impossible for him to understand what is for his own benefit, to understand what is for the benefit of others, to understand what is for the benefit of both, to realize a superior human state, a truly noble distinction in knowledge and vision. And then the Buddha goes on in the same sutta to offer an analogy for how the five hindrances affect our practice effort. So he says, suppose there were a river flowing down from the mountains, going far, its current swift, carrying everything with it. And a man would open channels leading away from it on both sides so that the current of the middle of the river would be dispersed, diffused, and dissipated. It wouldn't go far, its current wouldn't be swift, and it wouldn't carry everything with it. So when our, you know, in our effort and our practice, these, when we, and I love this word, it's a, we talk about abandoning the hindrances. So we're not, you know, fighting the hindrances or overcoming the hindrances, killing the hindrances. Abandoning suggests we're holding on to the hindrances. Like there's some way in which we are actually buying into the hindrances, and what we need to do is actually let them go. So let's start with sense desire, which I think, I mean, we could do a bunch of Dharma talks just on, you know, what does it really mean that desire is a hindrance, and how does that fit in with our love of life and blah, blah, blah. But as I said, this is I kind of like the term worldly desire. So the Pali term is kama chanda. The kama of kama chanda is K-A-M-A, one M, not two. So kama with two M's is the, you know, cause and the moral laws of cause and effect. So this isn't that kama. This kama means worldly desire, wish, or longing. And so this is a word that is usually used to like characterize our world, our phenomenal world. It's the world of desire. And then the meaning of chanda, I just love this. In the Vinaya, the monastic regulations, chanda, monastic environment from the time of the Buddha and still today, it's run democratically. So there will be meetings of the community, and the community meets to review the rules and confess to shortcomings and make decisions and whatever. So there's community meetings. And if you can't go to one of the community meetings for one reason or another, you send, and I'm not sure if this is just like your verbal or written permission, or you send a person. I wasn't clear about that. But you send your chanda to the meeting, basically saying that you endorse or accept what the group comes up with. So you're giving your permission, your acceptance, your endorsement to what the group says. So in this case, then, you know, when we think about this is desire for kama, is desire for anything in our life, anything in the world that is remotely attractive, interesting, positive. So it's not just, I mean, it includes, but it's not just sensual pleasure. It's not just lust or longing for food or comfort or things like that. But it's also, I mean, anything that gives us excitement or pleasure or ease or whatever. So my example, like, I feel like this is where I primarily get stuck these days is, I mean, I love my projects. I love working on my projects and completing my projects and improving things, and I think about things that can improve it right way, and I think about, you know, how I could design my garden, and I'm just like, these are all, I mean, worldly, not in a derogatory sense, but it's true. This is the world, and I'm thinking about it. So what goes from desire, just a like, oh, that's nice, that's lovely, I enjoy that, I appreciate that, in kind of an open-handed way, to the hindrance of kamachanda, is either like we are attached to these things, we want more of them, we're kind of obsessed with getting them, or we're like, this is the chanda part of this, is we're giving permission to our those concerns to occupy our mind. So I'm kind of surprised that I didn't include this quote, but Ajahn Brahmavamsa is somebody that I quote in my podcast, and he says something about kamachanda means you are giving your permission, your invitation, your endorsement. You know, you are giving yourself over to all these concerns to occupy you. So you're like, it kind of goes beyond just like, yeah, I love that, my garden's lovely, but instead, he says, you're playing with it. You're spending your time just playing with all of these worldly delights. So there's some images in the Pali Canon about the different hindrances that I think are kind of fun and help us understand this. One is you're trying to see a reflection on a surface of water in a pail. So you're going to, you know, let's say that's the goal of our practice, is to see a clear reflection of of our face, say. If you are overcome with this hindrance, kamachanda, or worldly obsession, it's like the water is made opaque with dye or paint or whatever. I mean, it's got stuff in it, so it's no longer reflective. Another analogy, so for each one, I'm going to share like a pail of water analogy, and then there's another one. And the other analogy is being lost in enjoyment, but in the meantime, like what you are as you are enjoying this, you're incurring debt as you indulge. You're incurring debt, which if you ignore it, if you just get lost in the pleasure and neglect your spiritual practice, eventually you're gonna pay. I mean, and the payment is going to be, we're unprepared for the disappointment and suffering that comes with change and loss. If we're really trying to just seek lasting permanent refuge in all the pleasures of our life, eventually we're gonna feel that if we're neglecting our spiritual practice. So I will, and because I'm kind of, I'm going to go through all five. If anybody has any questions, like along the way, just go ahead and kind of, jump in, because maybe by the time we end, we may not remember the questions about this particular hindrance.
This can be as broad as just wanting life to be the way I want it to be. Yes.
Yeah, although there's another hindrance of like restlessness and worry, which is kind of similar, which is responding to the sense of dukkha in our lives. But yeah, I think it can be subtle. Yeah.
So when you were talking about attachment to something, or really being caught up in something or obsessed by or with something, I was thinking of, when you mentioned your gardening for yourself, I was thinking of Luther Burbank, who as a very young person got extraordinarily interested in seeds and propagation of plants and so forth, and actually became world famous and developed all sorts of strands of various kinds of flowers and vegetables. And there's a part of what he did that is simply extraordinary and wonderful. He was a kind of a genius who was obsessed with his passions, passionate interest. So how does that fit in with what you were talking about?
Well, that is why I spend so much time on the cushion, because I've got these are noble purposes. This is a sincere passion. Part of what I'm thinking about is how to share the Dharma and make the Sangha more vital, and it's all good. And I refuse to believe it's bad. I guess what for myself is I'm like, and I have to be just honest with myself. I love devoting myself passionately to my interests, but at what point are they? At what point are they consuming me and I don't have any choice in the matter? If I'm sitting down and I'm like, look, in the morning when we have this online meditation, I've designated 50 minutes. I know how important Zazen is to my life. I really want to devote myself to Zazen. But then I sit there and I think about my projects instead, which suggests to me I have not developed choice. That's some choice in the matter, but I could develop more choice in the matter. And I don't think this is a beautiful thing about Buddhism. There's no like moral right and wrong. If I want to just devote myself passionately to something, that's not evil. But if you look at people who have devoted themselves in that way, they've suffered, and the people around them have suffered. In some way, they have suffered from that imbalance in their lives. They die early. They can't maintain their relationships. I mean, it's inspiring. You look at these people who just you know, clearly they just thought about this all day long. But there was a cost. It's up to us. It's our choice, you know. Do you want to burn out your candle devoting yourself to this cause? Okay. But then there's also the argument that if you are just devoting yourself in that way, there's a potential you might actually do harm when you're intending to do good because you don't have the clarity and perspective to make wise choices. So I don't know if that would address. Because I don't know, when I go to retreat sometimes and there's cut off thought. And I'm like, I like thought. I like creativity. I like, you know, like my spiritual practice can't reject that. It has to incorporate. How can that be incorporated? How can we actually live our lives in a wholehearted way and do this spiritual practice, not just kind of one or the other? But I do feel like, I mean, if we choose these times where we're going to put that stuff aside. I think that's what's so valuable about the time we slot for Zazen and the time that we might slot for retreat. For this time, we're going to set it aside. And it takes me a couple days at session to actually put it aside. It takes several days of like, oh, and then finally I'm like, all right, really? Like, I think about this all the time, 24/7, and I can't put it down for a few days. And then when I put it down, it feels like I'm usually a hamster on a wheel and I've just gotten off the wheel. Because there's a certain kind of compulsion, like, I'll fix it, I'll finish it, it'll be great, that I'm not aware of, that's underlying that supposedly pure passion. And then when I get off that wheel, I'm like, oh. Yeah. All right, so let's go on to ill will, which is vyapada. It can also be translated as malice. Refers to the hateful wish that harm will befall another. Now, to some extent, you can generalize this and just think of this as aversion, but it's really interesting to see how often our aversion. It most of the time it's tied in some way to resenting someone. So, you know, there's, so ill will ranges from subtle irritation and dislike to bitter resentment to fury that can fuel aggression and violence. It can take the form of a specific fantasy of revenge or a conscious wish for someone to get their comeuppance. But it can also take the form of just a more general, vague lack of goodwill. You know, you don't necessarily wish, oh, I just hope Dave, something miserable happens to Dave, but I can just kind of be withholding goodwill. Like, I don't really care if something does happen. So an ill will can be aimed at anyone, specific people, groups of people, human institutions. This is a big one for me, a nameless and faceless other who's to blame. Or ourselves. So it's important to differentiate between, you know, as the, you know, ill will, anger, all these kinds of things. Is, again, it's a rich topic you could spend many Dharma talks on. So it's important to distinguish again in each of these cases, just like, you know, appreciation for our life, passionate service needs to be differentiated from the hindrance. The wholesome use of discriminating wisdom and compassion to keep appropriate boundaries, to protect what needs protecting, that's fine. The hindrance of ill will is when we take that anger or that resentment and we dwell on it and nurture it. We don't just, you know, take a rising of anger as like, you know, I think maybe something might need be protecting here. And then you can let that feeling go. Instead, and I think all of us we've all experienced this, or sometimes it's easier to witness it in somebody else, you know, what they're just like, hashing over and over and over and over this wrong that has been done them, and this, oh, and these people, and, you know, this injustice. And even if they have a point, after a while, it's just like, I've heard the story 100, okay, now what? You know, now what are we going to do? So we can get really stuck in that. And the analogy for this is you're trying to see the reflection in the water, but the water's boiling. Or we're suffering from a sickness. And as long as we're suffering from a sickness, we can't, not only can't practice, but we can't appreciate anything. Oh, and then I guess just to quickly cover in terms of how we abandon these things. So I kind of skipped over that for the worldly obsession. But the first step is mindfulness, noticing that this has arisen, noticing that this is present. And even that can be a powerful step, just rather than being completely consumed. Oh, look, you know, ill will has arisen in me. Then we notice through that mindfulness what is feeding. It's called the nutriments. What are the nutriments of that hindrance? And, you know, typically, concentrating on, you know, the objects of our sense desire, or dwelling on the subject or the event of our resentment, just, you know, fuels all of that. So a really sweet thing is that two of the ways to deal with the hindrances. So every hindrance has a little bit of a specific antidote, but these are general. What applies to everyone is if you're dealing with a hindrance, you know, mindfulness, you look at the nutriments, you turn to noble friendship and suitable conversation. Which I think is really, so the antidotes have to do more like, well, you know, how do you turn your own mind? But I love this, Buddhism is a really practical religion, you know? It's just like, yeah, and one of the ways to get over these hindrances is noble friendship and suitable conversation. So that noble friendship, you know, which I think hopefully many of us find in Sangha, maybe you find it elsewhere as well, that's wonderful. But people who are going to, they're going to be supportive, but they're not necessarily just going to feed your hindrance. They're going to be concerned about your well-being. And perhaps somewhere along the line, they change the topic to some more kind of more suitable conversation. You know, somebody's really stuck on their negative, you know, ill will, and be like, okay, you know, I've listened for a while now, you know, how's your job going? You know, I mean, like, changing it to something positive, not rehashing the same things over and over. So for each one, you know, so there's the mindfulness, looking at the nutriments, noble friendship and suitable conversation. And then just in terms of those kind of internal antidotes for sense desire, one of the traditional ways is to go into a charnel ground and meditate on burning corpses. I don't see a lot of people taking that on. But, you know, this is, if you look in the Pali Canon, you see these meditations, and sometimes it's a meditation on the body and how the body's really just composed of, like, organs and slime and blood and pus and, you know. So clearly these are about, it's because these are like direct, you know, if you're all caught up, maybe you're infatuated with somebody and how beautiful they are, then you deconstruct that. You know, a more mild way of thinking about this is just kind of trying to bring yourself down to earth a little bit. I think, like, maybe you're infatuated with somebody and you know you probably shouldn't get involved with them, but they're, oh my God, they're just so wonderful. And then you can remind yourself, yeah, well, that's what you thought about so-and-so in that last relationship, which really didn't turn out very well. You know, like, just kind of trying to deconstruct a little bit that, you know, that glorious picture we often have of this thing or this person or this whatever. But also contemplating impermanence, that anything that we take this desire, you know, this pleasure in, is going to change. We're going to lose it. And that's not, again, not a reason not to appreciate it, but it's a reason not to put all your eggs in that basket and ignore your spiritual practice. And then in terms of ill will, the antidote, the kind of direct antidote, the kind of redirecting your mind antidote, is metta practice. So that's calling to mind someone and trying to actively wish them, you know, send goodwill, wishing them to be happy, at ease, free from fear and anxiety. Now, the good thing is you don't have to practice metta for the object, the subject of your ill will. That's the most challenging form of metta. I mean, if you can do that, that's great. But all you have to do is call to mind someone for whom you can spontaneously feel that. For some of us, maybe our pet is the easiest, you know, a child. Somebody we feel very uncomplicated, just goodwill toward. Somebody who's been very kind to us. It doesn't matter that we're not feeling it for the subject of our ill will. We're feeling it. Just cultivating some goodwill is something of an antidote to that ill will we were dwelling on. And then, so there's kind of two basic antidotes: redirecting the mind, and then contemplating the negative effects of not abandoning the hindrance. So when you contemplate the negative effects of holding on to ill will, you know, there's the metaphors of, like, you pick up a hot coal to throw at someone, you know, and you're actually burning yourself more severely, or you're picking up some excrement to throw at someone. You know, like the harm that you're doing yourself, you're imagining that, you know, just holding on to this is somehow protecting you or harming this other person or whatever, but it's not. It's actually harming you, or drinking poison in order to hurt somebody else. You know, contemplating those kinds of things, or I kind of like the one too, when you're angry, you're really ugly and unlikable, and that will just make your enemy happy. I don't know, these ways of, like, I think of this also kind of like talking yourself out of holding on to the, I think of that friend that has bored us with the, you know, long negative diatribe, and think, I don't really want to be like that, you know. So, I mean, these may have limited effectiveness or not, but, and people often are asking, like, you know, do we do this while we're sitting on the meditation cushion, or what, you know, like, we're supposed to be just letting go. But I find, you know, we can turn toward this deliberate practice at various times. Sometimes maybe you are sitting there on the meditation cushion and you realize, like, okay, you know, I have just spent 30 minutes dreaming about my garden. All right, take a moment and identify the hindrance and maybe apply some antidote, and then go back to zazen. I mean, if you can, just going to that practice of zazen is abandoning the hindrances. So if you can do it just directly by returning to the physical act of sitting, that's great. But sometimes we're a little caught up. All right. So you can see what this turned into, 3 podcast episodes. There's a lot here. So I can go on to, it's already noon, and we usually go to 12:15, but I've still got sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and uncertainty. So do you want, maybe we should just stop there, and I can continue this some other Sunday, and we can just talk about what we've talked about so far. I mean, it's kind of helpful to know all 5 of the hindrances so you know how they relate. So let me just very briefly explain what the other 3 are. So sloth and torpor, that's like I said, that's a compound, tina, mita. And sloth is basically our unwillingness to strive. And torpor is the resultant dullness of mind and body that happens. And then they're seen as happening together and kind of a feedback loop. You know, so sometimes it's kind of a dullness of mind and body, and then we don't want to bother to strive. but then we get duller and, you know, so it's kind of a self-fulfilling thing. And then restlessness and worry, this is that monkey mind. So this isn't so much, have that positive quality of like playing with the, you know, delightful things of the world. This is basically like, this is the default mode of the mind. The mind is unsatisfied and it's just going to keep on. If it doesn't have anything else to do, if it's not being entertained, it has no task. It's just going to like, it doesn't want to just be still. It doesn't want to just face emptiness or, you know, let the self fade. It wants to like, you know, rehearse last night's TV show or whatever other than just being silent. It's got, you know, you need me, you need me. I must keep on with my activity. So it's just kind of random activity, or the worry aspect, you know, which we're all familiar with, is like reflecting on stuff we've done and, you know, how is it impacted now? What am I doing right now that might impact the future? Blah. So that's restlessness and worry. And then the fifth is uncertainty or skeptical doubt. And the analogy for this one is that you're lost in a desert without a map. So this isn't questioning. This isn't, validly questioning things in order to experience it for yourself. Is this true? This is, I feel like you can tell when it's skeptical doubt, when you're questioning something, but actually if you look, you're not questioning, you think you know the answer and it's a negative answer. So it may sound like you're saying, I don't know if I am capable of this practice. But really skeptical doubt is, I'm not capable of this practice. And then you're kind of just like, and so particularly this uncertainty or skeptical doubt has to do with our practice. You're doubting Buddhism, you're doubting meditation, you're doubting your Sangha, you're doubting your teacher, you're doubting yourself, you're doubting, you know, whatever it is you have adopted as your path. So that's why you're lost in the desert without a map, because you're doubting the whole thing, which leaves you kind of, you know, what are you supposed to do? It deprives you of the ability to really act and practice. So anyway, those are the other three, real quick. Open it up to questions and discussion. Yeah.
I wish you could just repeat that in the last couple sentences. So if there is that desert with no map or whatever, how best do you come
to, well, and that's to do about it? So that's where we get the how do we practice with it, which I didn't get a chance to talk. How do we practice with uncertainty? But very briefly, it's, so you look at what is, you know, once again, you notice, all right, I'm feeling this way. What is feeding it? Maybe you are, I don't know, maybe you're reading something that is really confusing you, or maybe you're talking to somebody who's making you doubt yourself, or I don't know. Maybe there's something that you can change. Then there's noble friendship and suitable conversation. So if you know that you really do want, you know, it's like, well, so far this path has really seemed to be fruitful and I really want to devote myself to it. So then you come to Sangha and you hear an inspiring Dharma talk, or you talk to a friend, or you talk to a teacher or something about your doubts, and then you get a little, you know, encouraged. And then internally, I guess, you know, you contemplate the effects of not abandoning this hindrance, and you recognize, now I'm just frozen. Now I'm just full of doubt, and I can't do anything. So this is clearly not a very helpful situation. So I'll share this again when we talk more about uncertainty and skeptical doubt, but I'm a very skeptical person, very intellectual, skeptical person. So I wrote this poem always back to myself. So you say, I cannot have faith until I have proof. But you will never find the proof until you have faith. Question anything of real importance, God, enlightenment, magic, the fundamental goodness of the human heart, and the incontestable evidence is invisible to the skeptic. You say, then this evidence is merely delusion conjured up by wishful thinking. But those who have proven it to themselves know this is not the case. They dance with exuberance, free from doubt. You say they are dancing because they've put blinders on and ignore the dismal and dreary truth. But while they are dancing, what are you doing? So to some extent, it's about taking a leap of faith. It's, you know, our practice does not, it's not blind faith in the sense, we're asked to verify it for ourselves, but not necessarily at every step. You know, we have to kind of keep on going even when it's not necessarily clear why or what's going to happen. And we expect to get some verification, but we have to take, it's like, faith and doubt are like two steps in walking. We have to have faith that the ground is going to be there to support us. Otherwise, we, you know, shiver in bed all day. So,
Also, I think that if you have the set with doubt, which I've been, you think, what's the alternative? How else are you going to live your life if you're not going to question the teachings with everything that you've got, but wrestle with the teachings? So you may not have proof, but it's a worthy way to live your life, even if you're beset with doubt. If you didn't do this practice, what else would you do with your life? Right? What would you replace that with? That's what keeps me going. And after a certain point, there's no way you can't do it, even if you don't have proof. And looking for proof is also a hindrance.
And so there we are in the desert, right? And somebody's handed us a map, and they said, you know, I heard so-and-so found their way out of the desert with this. I mean, you don't know. You hope. But, you know, probably better to just start following that map and see how things turn out than to just sit there.
Yeah.
Anything about hindrances in general, or worldly obsession, or ill will?
It's all there.
Should I?
I kind of feel like it is the path. You know what I mean? It's like the worldly hindrances. If you could do this perfectly, like right out of the gate, there wouldn't be much to do. Maybe I should just be for myself. I bumped up against all of those things, and I think it's like course correct, course correct, course correct, course correct. And I love that there are actual anecdotes that are part of the teaching, so you don't just have to stumble around trying to figure it all out for yourself. Yeah. But especially the one about friendships and what was it? What noble
suitable conversation and noble friendship.
Yeah, it's like in layman's terms, like check in with somebody.
I know, and this is from like 2,000 years ago. These monks, you know, so kind of like, so people haven't changed that much. All right, right. You know, these diligent monks were like, yeah, well, totally. Yeah.
We should go talk to somebody about that. That's how you'd hear it today, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like I do that with somebody. Be like, I do that with Mark quite a bit. I'll send him a message like, so I don't really get this. What's your take on it? So yeah, it's really.
And how often when we're caught up in these hindrances, so another aspect of them is that they are they are intoxicating and self-perpetuating. So when we're caught up in one of the hindrances, we just want to stay caught up in the hindrance. That's the nature of them. So even just becoming mindful is becoming slightly less caught up. Just noticing, oh, this is going on for me, is a start. And then just noticing, oh, that thing's making it worse. Like, you're completely obsessed with buying a new car, right? So probably doesn't help to spend hours car shopping on the internet just before you meditate. I mean, you know, it's just like the kind of practical things that you can, you know, so you kind of turn, you're extricating yourself a little bit from that thing. You're making the choice to go a little bit away from it. And then, who do we really want to call when we're feeling that way? When we're caught up in ill will, we want to call that person who understands this, you know, what this awful thing that's happened to us, and they can go like, yeah, oh, what an asshole, wow, you know. That's who we really want to call, right? We don't want to call a noble friend who will just be like, you know, do you think maybe if you, you know, talk to them, or maybe you're expecting too much, or, you know, I don't know. Yeah.
In terms of spiritual matters, I think the quote-unquote proof is more what we actually experience and realize through our own experiencing of the world, as opposed to intellectualizing or reading philosophical or religious tracts about something.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes we're even, at a certain point, it can feel like we're lacking even that confirmation. Or we've, you know, confirmed so far, but now we're faced with a decision or something that we're not so clear about. And I don't know, like, you can always, if you're going to go down the road of skeptical doubt, you can always find something to doubt. Yes. Especially if it's about yourself. Yes. You can just, I mean, yeah, you're convince yourself that, you know, you've been deluded all along and you're actually a failure. I mean, what kind of proof could come out that that's not the case? You know, and somebody will be like, no, but you, I mean, you know, you have friends and, you know, you've had a successful job or something, and you know, you're just like, God, none of that matters. You know, we just, because what's the proof? There's no, like, award that, you know, like a pin on your chest, like you are a truly wonderful person, and now you know for sure you are. That's just not the way it works. So at some point I realized, like, I just have to be my own fan. Maybe I'll be wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. But who else is going to be my fan? I gotta think I'm okay. Well, that's true. That is why we have them, isn't it?
That's why Buddhism is so wonderful, because it says that every single person, no matter what you've done, where you've been, you have to the nature. I think that you don't need, I mean, maybe you want proof of that, but the fact that they've said that, you know, people who know have said that, that you have with the nature, that the ways that you're blocking it is, one of them is doubt, you know.
Well, thank you all.